Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 7 of The Iron Monarch, a classic marine story by Dennis Bainbridge. And it is absolutely classic. So, just to put you in the story so far, Australia had a problem of dispersed industry requiring mega steel for their mining operations to build it, the quarrying operations and stuff like that. So we required large amounts of homegrown steel. Unionised rail. So the BHP had this idea to get a boat which is designed to destroy all in front of it and put it with a jet engine. This is a gas turbine. Basically, it is a jet engine. And this had some basic problems with it. One is that the shit fuel and the high temperature meant that you had these elements ingressing in, destroying your engine. And you also had this boat, which had a jet engine which could only operate at a particular speed, so the propellers had to rotate at a constant rate per minute, which means a variable pitch blade, but indeed this is a complete anathema, and it had to convert from diesel to its jet fuel, which is actually not expensive as jet fuel, but much, much cheaper than it, using waste waxy product from it. This wax wasted product actually had to be refined in the ship, so it's taken on board and refined in the ship. Then if you were taking all sorts of waste, they put different types of waste they hadn't planned for, which destroyed the ship. So after less than 10 years it was scrapped, but indeed full-on history. It was just absolutely entertaining, and we're reading through the different safety problems coming across, and this is beautiful. So the ramp problems, so this is, it had a ramp. This is before, it was just at the twilight of ancient shipping, before the containerization, and so it was sort of like a hybrid container ship inside it, with its own little ramp which would come down and allow trucks to drive in and off it. It's sort of a beautiful idea. Of course, the ramp was so high that it acted as a sail, and so this ramp acted as a sail to push it off, making it hard to get in. And of course, there were accidents agog, absolutely amazing. So this is general operation in the accident section. A mere 3 months after the vessel entered service, Cyclone Tracy struck Darwin and badly damaged the harbour infrastructure. BHP offered the services of the Ro-Ro, which could have loaded many trucks' loads for urgent supplies and materials and landed them onto the Darwin Wharf with its flexible stern ramp. This vessel didn't have a sprinkler system on the cargo spaces. DOT, read AMSA, said no petrol-driven vehicles were to be carried in the vehicle deck. Well, there you go. This is a union, I suppose. Australian Maritime, whatever it is. Gradually, the order was achieved. By the time the sister ship Iron Duke came into service, all operators were up to speed. A special loading jetty had been completed at Port Kembla for exclusive use of two Ro-Ro ships. It was a delight to see a complete steel cargo loading Port Kembla, some 5 to 10 times faster than conventional stevedoring. Also, with the ability to handle cargo in all weathers, the most total elimination of damaged cargo clams. The people who developed this concept were justified in feeling pleased with their baby. BHP senior management were cautiously optimistic. In the chairman's 74 annual report, Sir Ian McLennan remarked, quote, "The matter of transport of finished products to market is always one of prime concern to us. We brought into operation during the year two specialised roll-on, roll-off." That's what Ro means. That's what Ro-Ro means, roll-on, roll-off. I wish we knew that. "Steel product carriers of our own design. The operation of these unique vessels to date has been such as to encourage us to think that a major step forward has been made in the sea transport of our products. So that's what RORO means, roll on, roll off. And they couldn't get it up to Darwin for a great heroic thing, because it didn't have sprinkler systems in it. And you wouldn't want sprinkler systems in, because your iron core, iron things are not going to go. It would seem the new cargo system was well ahead of customers' ability to receive and handle such large volumes. The bolsters would ideally have been taken straight to the factory, warehouse and construction sites, instead of still had to be unloaded to the forklift trucks for delivery. A return to the old system of 5-ton lifts from which BHP were attempting to escape. This double handling and lack of land-backed wharf space would kill the project. This is the real reason for the failure of the coastal containers. Well, isn't that amazing? They didn't really plan it all the way. Both ships would arrive at the same port, and one would have to anchor off. While others slowly discarded cargo on the wharves, piled high with customers' unreceived steel. This, together with the rapidly rising fuel costs in the world's first oil crisis, was an early design system make sailing into trouble. The vessel regenerator problems, which meant the vessels were converted to simple cycle, meant less speed and more fuel consumption. The regenerators had let her down. So it's the regenerators, unions, and the tugs. The tugs and Port Kembla were quite modern, easily controlled manoeuvres, such as it was not uncommon to see one hotshot tug operator in particular relaxing in his chair while using his feet to carry out some required control functions. One operator delighted in charging straight up to the ship, as if to ram it before going astern and stopping inches from the berth hull, tuck under high astern load. Most other operators would approach the vessel in an appropriate manner, because it took time for the crew to let go and retrieve the moorings. It was inevitable that one day the operator would misjudge it, and it came to pass that it ploughed into the port side under speed, causing moderate damage to the Monarch and limped away, shoved it in nose on the tug, a chorus of raspberries from the crew. The Iron Monarch was still fully berthed alongside and was delayed whilst class inspected the damage and issued the ship with a condition of class. A BHP also was liable for repair of the tug's damage. A phenomenon is cloaked in an old English law. As far as anybody knows, the tug operator never held to account. Well, there you go. Chapter 10. Conversion to a slab carrier. The Iron Monarch was laid up at Leewolf, Newcastle, on the March 9th, 1983, and offered for sale. The downturn in the steel business, coupled with the high price of fuel and the withdrawal and the conversion to simple cycle resulting in reduced speed, were all factors in her withdrawal from service. This could have been the end of the ship until the steelworks elected to upgrade its slab casting process to continuous cast slabs of up to 12.2 metres in length and weighed 30 tonnes. These new slabs could not be accommodated in the A&L ships Lissa Light Endeavour and Lissa Light Enterprise. So, Australian, there's unionised ships as well. As their loading procedure was to use forklift trucks to pick up the slabs and drive them to the ship with a slab athwart ships, which meant they would need 13-metre wide door to load the new slabs. The story of what happened next is best told in the Iron Ships publication, Spring 88. The article explains that the fleet management were asked, would the Iron Monarch be re-engined to convert into a slab carrier? With a yes answer, the project was conceived. On June 12, 1985, a memo from R. Stevenson, manager, Fleet Manager Operations, was sent to all masters and chief engineers, advising that due to the 82-83 downturn, improved productivity was essential, and as a result, the cost of slab transport from Port Kembla to Westmont had been studied, and as a result, an existing A&L contract would be terminated in July 86. The A&L vessels would not ship the new long slabs now being produced at Port Kembla. The BHP board decided to re-engine the Iron Monarch and convert it to carry slabs using sample facilities. The Iron Monarch was selected over the Iron Duke because she was in Newcastle, while the Iron Duke was laid up in Sydney and faced high towing costs to Newcastle. The Iron Duke had damage to one of its diesel alternators. God, come on. This is amazing. Come on. So I'm just fiddling around here. There's a page that's stuck. The same engines had been used in the conversion of the Iron Capricorn and the Iron Curtis in the 83-84 work that was performed by G.H. Varley. BHP appointed John McClure to head the project and assisted C. Randall and Christie and other personnel. The gas turbine regenerators were removed through the side of the vessel. Oh my god. And new engines plates were completed in December 85. The new propulsion system could be slid into place. The new engines could use residual fuel of at 360 CST. The fuel consumption in service was 35.5 tonnes per day at 80% powered, loaded speed at 15.5 knots and 17.5 with ballast on return voyage. To carry slabs to hold needed modification, cell guards were removed and the slab restraints installed, plus grids made, plus 75mm square bullets were loose laid to tank top guard against slabs peeling off the new crane lifting magnets. A constant problem over the years was the very poor tank drainage in the double bottom ballast tanks. There had been reluctance to burn larger drain holes as this would destroy the dimmets coating. These were the last Whaler built ships with stripping pumps. All later tonnage had educators drawing ballast water urns from the tank bottom to the Venturi system. That's interesting. As pumps could be left to strip tanks unattended by a duty man who was always busy with cargo handling process, despite many requests for this problem to be corrected at the time of the conversion, funds had been exhausted. The problem was finally corrected with the fitting of educators in 1990s. What on earth is an educator? I don't understand. Slab magnetic lifting beam. My God. Three ship's cranes were converted from a bolster spreaders to magnetic beam type arrangement. Lifting capacity of 30 tonnes, which required larger wires. To allow the uneven slabs, an equalising system of sub-beams contained in the main beam with 8 magnets each. Now, the lifting capacity for each magnet was 20 tonnes. However, the 6mm air gap would reduce the capacity to 4.5 tonnes. The large slab weighs 29 tonnes. There was a wide safety margin. Now, of course, this is around the time all the this is the time when there was cash and safes. There was policing of magnets in Australia because of magnet jobs. That is, people who would go up to safes with a magnetic drill, fix it on the side of the safe and drill in. There was apparently a few magnet jobs, but people didn't really know about this. A further safety feature is the magnets were split into two groups with two independent 240 volt power supplies. The ship's main power is used by the group battery bank and used second group. There are many supervisory systems of the safe operations. The essential modification is the installation of slow zones and other limits to the crane travel and hoist systems. Electromagnets were manufactured as each magnet weighed 1 ton. In the vehicle deck, each larger pontoons were cut in two, and the larger cargo platoon had an additional 50mm thick plate attached to increase the flux density to permit safe lifting of the power magnets. That's 84. My God, here's a picture. Wow. On March 3rd, 86, there was a discussion between fleet operations and bands of flex regarding stability, high GM, and the inability to utilise stability tank. The physical limits of the gantry cane across the travel was set at 4.6 90mm. Examination of the slab sizes suggests that it would be able to lift up to 7 of the narrower slabs and 3 to 4 of the wider slabs across, leaving a 50mm gap between slabs. The slab sizes were not ideal for the ship's requirements. Oh my God, they are pretty big slabs of steel. The proposed prospect of carrying Lisa-like coils on the vehicle deck was examined, however, not implemented due to the rush to the enter of the slab trade. The decision was taken not to use the vehicle deck for slab cargo, which was to cause severe rolling the vessel entered service. So if you put the big slabs up the top of the vehicle and the deck, it would go, these are pretty heavy decks. My godfather. The new slab trucks, new Valmet SH saddle trucks, figure 49, were ordered at $500,000 each and supplied by Clyde APAC. The new trucks had two Volvo Penta D four-stroke diesel horsepower engines and two Clark two-speed transmissions, giving a top speed of 30 kilometres per hour. They had a four-wheel drive and steering. The new trucks were not as tall as the old bolster trucks, which allowed improved clearance when entering and leaving the vehicle decks. The trucks operated with one engine and two-wheel drive with restrictions. Slab-covering grab arms contact the side of the slab with a force of 240 tons, which allows a nipper piece to dig several millimetres into the slab, allowing the slab to be lifted. The expected life of these trucks was advised at 10 years, and 26 years later, they're still working. The Clyde APAC Mechanics incorporated many improvements in the trucks, which have increased the reliability and improvements such as incorporated in truck design. Isn't that amazing? The trucks were gives you the entire idea that BHP were just off their face compared to, if you can imagine, the Germans planning the 1940 invasion of France. They had everything down to clockwork, and here we've just lost it. Pretty sad. We haven't learned anything. Clyde APAC Mechanics have incorporated many improvements to these trucks, which have increased the reliability, and many improvements have been incorporated into the truck design. And you can imagine nowadays. These trucks were designed with two side frames being connected by a single cross member H, allowed more flexible frame to counteract the stresses caused by traversing the ramp angles under load. The old stiff bolster model trucks suffered frame cracking, which was a constant problem. You can imagine that. You imagine nowadays you do finite element analysis. The work was completed in June 86, and she left Newcastle on the 22nd of June 86 for sea trials berthing at Port Kembla. On June 23, 86, a meeting on the 25th with all involved personnel, accountants, stevedores, steel industry, industrial relations, however, not fleet operations, were where it made known that all funds for the ship conversion had been expended. The sum of $171,000 had been approved for the loading of slabs of the vehicle deck, however, not carried out. A similar sum of the ship conversion costs, approximately $6 million, had been allocated for the conversion work at Western Port, was still work in progress. My godfather. You can think of it now, a house costs $1 million in Australia, so it's pretty amazing. Port Kembla was allocated a smaller amount for its slab storage and handling requirements. For the next 39 days, the ship sat in Port Kembla waiting to load cargo, but also training wharfies to handle the gantry cranes, using several slabs on board for that purpose. Loading commenced on August 1st and completed the 5th. The ship was back in service. Unfortunately, the vessel completed loading at a time of inclement weather that closed the Port Kembla port, But the swell was so heavy that a small heavy lift ship, Gabriella, loaded with heavy machinery components for the new continuous slab caster, had cargo shift and developed a list to the extent that she was in danger, required other vessels to stand off her by the coast. Later, during discharge of the cafe, Gabriella capsized and sank without loss of life. When the hoist wire failed, dropping heavy load onto a low loader truck, allowing a Boonson type counterweight, caused the ship to heel over. Onboard decisions not to sail immediately coincided with the harbour master's decision to close the port. Oh my god, the delay is utilised to construct devices to tighten and lower the hold stow. Unfortunately, the poor shape of the ingot root type slabs being loaded at the time, the bridging pieces soon worked loose. When the ship did sail, the swell was still heavy and the ship rolled heavily and quickly, with virtually everything in the ship sliding around, causing damage. Metacentric height of some 6.5 metres. One of the points made in submission to gain approval from the authorities was that no personnel were required in the vehicle deck for loading and discharging cargo. On that basis, there was no provision for guarding open holds. Surprisingly, no thought had been given to the fact that open holds, about 8 metres deep, needed to be inspected regularly by duty officers and foremen while engaged in directly supervising the loading. Accordingly, handrail arrangements were required for the vehicle deck areas between gantries for when the platoons were removed, required for the vehicle deck areas between the gantries when the platoons were removed. Initially, the ship achieved a safe walkway by means of not having adjacent platoons removed. However, only moderate danger till a resolution was achieved. Eventually, handrails were prefabricated in Newcastle and belatedly fitted on board. As time allowed, some were installed by ship staff while at sea. The authorities could have restricted cargo operations or cease operations until the handrails were in place. Masters of the 6 months, of the first 6 months, were Jeff Herbert and Mike Rainbow. It was evident that the early fears were confirmed, as the ship was too stiff and the fume tank was not effective. The GM was up to 7 metres, which resulted in 30 hours of horrific rolling and some injuries suffered by the crew. The crew morale suffered as every load rolling of some injuries as every loaded voyage was often the period of lost sleep. There was extensive damage to furniture. At one stage, the steward's store was destroyed. Life on the ship due to this pounding would be reduced. Captain Jeff Herbert says he was often worried about the watchkeepers walking out on the bridge wings during some of the heavy rolls. Another problem was exposed in Western Port Berth when, on several occasions, strong westerly winds threatened to break stern ropes, and the ramp down would have been a disaster if the ramp collided with the existing light span used by A&L ships. The master insisted on another rope and winch at the rear of the starboard side, and used an IHH hydraulic winch, was purchased from Taiwan ship breaker and fitted to the ship using a ramp hydraulics. A new fairhead was fitted to the starboard quarter, and new sets of mooring bits fitted on the poop. Additionally, the anemometer was placed on ramp A frames, which alarmed the blast boom if there was excessive wind force. My God. Wharfies were not happy about the extra ropes as his fixing point on land away from the wharf and ship. This problem was solved by leaving the rope permanently rigged so it could be easily raised and secured to the new winch. Also, there was no wharf area to place the ramp feeder, so the extension was installed to allow the sensor to be used. The mate had to climb down the ramp and set up the feeler to plate extension from the wharf. Peter Lamarck, who joined the ship in February 1987, found the vessel in a gale off Garbo Island and was woken up at 2 a.m. By the second mate, who told him that the magnetic compass binnacle was rolling around the upper bridge after shearing fore mounting loose in a heavy roll. This was a turning point, as it was realised that if the compass broke loose, anything could happen within the ship in this condition. The answer to correct the situation was to load slabs on the vehicle deck to reduce the GM to a safe level and the Ranger's stabilisation tank. It was easier said than done. After submission by Peter Lamarck around Easter 87, he was called to the Newcastle for discussion of the options and was finally agreed that the figures were to be checked by the Whaler Shipyard for the proposal to carry 50% of the slabs on the vehicle deck to reduce the GM to a reasonable level. So, well, there you go. This is the, I suppose this is the gravitational centre. The new rail arrangements were required for the platoon contact to fit the rails to the 8 platoon cost $20,000, which is the cost of a cheap used car nowadays. The rails are designed by Newcastle office. Questions were raised by the contractor about the specified number of weld runs to fix the rail base of the platoon. However, increased cost wasn't approved to upgrade the weld runs. The rails allowed a 4.67 metre width to store the slabs, which relied on the weight to stop movement. On November 16, 87, the platoons were landed for the modification using special prime movers with steerable boogies. To keep the ship operational, permission was obtained from the authorities to sail the ship without pontoons installed. The open holds were roped off. Six modified pontoons returned December 4th. Those six holds landed essential. This aft hold always had pontoons for the straddle track safety. Slabs were immediately loaded on the vehicle deck to ease the 15 months of pain, to reduce the GM by 4 metres to 2.5 metres, which gave the vessel roll a period of 12 seconds. Oh, far out. Oh. In terms of making you want to chunder, my godfather, and you can sort of see why Australia just couldn't compete. Figure 51. This shows the slabs stacked within the 6.5 metres. Godfather, they are big slabs of steel. Okay, figure 51 shows how the slabs were stacked within 4.65 metre space between the rails on the vehicle desk. No other stowing was used, relying on the weight, and the slabs stacked like a course of bricks to prevent any movement. Wow. Derek Slim had a procedure for loading slabs. First task was to walk the yard and survey the slabs, noting the line numbers, slab width, and number of slabs of each land, and doing it again to double-check the slab numbers. There were 3 points fixed. Maximise the number of slabs stowed in the vehicle desk to reduce the load discharge time because of the greatly reduced crane lift. Only a third of a lower hold stow. Try to have 20 to 30 slabs in G2, have 80 tons more G1 and G3 to minimise the vesicles, list, ramp and raise. My God. Sequencing the vehicle deck. With the available width of 4.6 metres, to aim was to get a batch of slabs together so it had a total width approaching 4.6 metres, bearing in mind the smallest outside slab, a D and a G, and G3 load 4, 3, 4, 5, 6 in vehicle deck, 5 being 24 metres long, which means we're able to put 2 12 metre stacks and 4 6 metre stacks on the pontoon lid. Similarly, G2 we load 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 with 3 and 5 being 24 metres long. The maximum height of the stow was 4 tiers. My God, this is an awful lot of steel. It's hard to imagine. Of course, what's happened is that the Australia is just compared, if you compared to Australia trying to do something, you can just see the space, the market's not there compared to Korea going up at this stage. It's pretty amazing to see across. It just means that we've got to be really super smart. Of course, when it comes to war, we're not going to be able to put all the steel together. Okay, sequencing the lower holes. Oh, God. This is slightly different, as available width being only 4.5 metres with the same restrictions above, the outside slabs G1, G2 and the first two tiers lower hole 4 are restricted by a gusset, which limits the available width to 2.5 metres on either side of it. The maximum stow height is 15 tiers. When sequencing this, the stow do vehicle decks G and 3 first allowed, followed by G2. Next sequence, G1 and G3 lower hold with the balance of slabs going to G2. It was easy to get sucked into sequencing the easy slabs first, or else you'll find all the rubbish left will not fit at all. After sequencing, the slab was calculated on a spreadsheet. You may find out that you may have to juggle slabs around, forward and aft, vice versa, to obtain the correct trim. It was not a great problem, as the vessel had 10 times the GM required for the IMO rules. Among the stern trim was not a great issue unless arriving Westernport at lower waters. Also, vehicle deck ships always work best near an even keel, and mates use ballast to maintain the level playing field. In 1989, Central Engineering sent a computer whiz down to develop the Fortran program to match odd slab sizes to a total of near 4.6 metres. It failed, as the mill sent down whatever width Westernport Mill asked for, and the chances that they would be 4.67 metres was very remote. We all loved the result. Stevedores and mates won, computer nil. Luckily, looking slabs were put aside for the top tiers. 1989. I don't understand why Fortran was. So, Fortran is. Oh, my father used to program. I used to program Fortran. I think it was still a numbered language. It was still do loops. It was still. It was just a bit like C++. Okay. There's, you know, really explicit linking and declarations. It was so hard. Luckily, looking slabs were put aside at the top tier and would lock the stow down and mitigate. At this stage, no slab fixing was used, although many ships wanted it. It was said that Western port wharfies would be unhappy with any arrangement suggested. And, of course, the bricks method remained, which relied on the weight of slabs to prevent any movement, provided stable stone. All very well, the slabs were dry with small gaps. My godfather, of course, this drilling industry is completely turfed up. I wonder what happens now. I think BHP has got out of steel manufacture. Another spreadsheet was used by the crew to calculate the GM. A special load computer from the old bolster days was reconfigured to calculate the final stability, dead weight and trim. This is mainly to meet the legal requirement. This is interesting because I think in this 89, I was going around the Australian bush with a little computer to guide me around this field. This is mainly to meet legal requirements that the metacentric height varied little voyage to voyage. The mate found it was easier to judge the water level in the stability tank by slightly overfilling and then dropping the water level until the satisfactory roll was established. Over the years, the vessel operated by an immense amount of local knowledge, probably much more than the average ship. About 1 in 1,000 slabs were affected by gravel or milius scale, which caused a gap between the magnet and the slab. This sometimes resulted in a drop slab, where the gravel came from was never sorted. But finally, the slab yard was cleared and smoothed. This operation could only improve with time. Okay. Incidents of the Slave Trade by Peter Lehmann. Upon rejoining the Iron Monarchs in February 87, it was great to see the vessel still looking as good as ever. Not only did the Dimmitt paint system, now its 14th year, remained a very attractive appearance, but the inside ballast tanks, void spaces, had no evidence of corrosion. Peter Lamarck rejoined 11 years away from the Ro-Ro ships. And so roll-on, roll-off ships. They were still using the same Ro-Ro jetty, the cargo marshalling yard, control tower, etc. However, we had new shuttle trucks fitted with closed-circuit cameras so the operators could identify the slab types they were handling. Somewhat lower than the older trucks, which had to lift bolsters in three high stacks, which barely made it through the sternway door, with only centimetres to spare. The crane spreaders had been removed. Goodbye to hydraulics and constant oil leaks. Now a cleverly designed flexi beam suspended the two cranes purchase wires. This beam had 8 magnets attached, which is, we're going over this again, to handle steel slabs to 12 metres length and 30 tonne mass. The advent of continuous casting method at Port Kembla Steelworks meant an endless supply of these slabs, which were the raw feed to the coated products rolling mill in Western Port. Some 400 sea miles distance. It may be asked, why would you have a rolling mill so far away from the blast furnace casting machine? This is a big question. The previous vessels in the slab trade were two specifically built Ro-Ro vessels of the Australian National Land Fleet. They were considerably smaller vessels than the Monarch, with no stern ramps or cranes to handle cargo in or out of the shore ships for Esfolkers. They did not have the ability to handle longer, wider, heavier slabs now coming from the stream. This was the reason for the replacement of the vessel. For the Port Kembla wharfies, this was an easy transmission. They had been operating the ship's cranes and straddle trucks since 73, loading some 13,500 tonnes of slabs into the Monarch's cargo holds was a 24-hour task, money for jam. Although no experience had been spared on the engineering version, straddle carriers or magnet attachment, it was well to bear in mind that everything else of the original vessel had already served 13 years of hard running. Some 3.5 million tonnes of steel have been carried around southeastern Australia during the past 200 voyages. Master Jeff Herbert and Michael Rainbird had been distressed to find the entire loading of slabs in the lower hold gave the vessel excessive GM, approximately 16 metres, very short roll period. The few months of summer service were already proving wearing on the ship and the crew. Winter gales promised real misery. The vessel was still a delight to handle, slipping out of the Ro-Ro berth with bow thrusters assistance, proceeding at a sedate 4 knots, past all carriers and ships at the coal loader vessels, cleared the inner harbour cutting, and took 90-degree swing to port with ease. Once clear of the harbour, the speed was increased until the engineers were satisfied they were 85% power. Thence, the electrical load transferred to the shaft alternator. On bridge, 2 new Sperry radars and the APR were the only new equipment. 12 hours later, the vessel rounded Gobbo Island. A swell of the southeast started the vessel rolling. The roll period was less than 8 seconds. Oh, God. Chunder vomit. The entire passage is just over 32 hours, although exempt from pilotage at the Western Port. The master was not visited within the past year, had to make 2 voyages in and out with a pilot before having the Iron Monarch endorsed upon his certificate. Western Port was wide and deep, dredged approach channel for over 100,000 tons crude carriers were regularly traded to and from the eastern states. However, the deep channels ends of the Long Point refinery berth and narrow buoy ditch with depth barely equal to the Iron Monarch's low draft continued onwards and a few cables of steel industry wharves did not much more than tied under her keel. And the southern side of these berths being row-row wharves, having a link span of the northern end to which the previous slab carriers had discharged their cargoes. Once through the channel was marked by a green buoy slightly less than two ships' lengths from the south dolphin vessel, which could commence the swing. The extra dolphin and a connecting catwalk were only concession to larger vessels' presence at the berth. It was obvious that the vessel would never be able to use this channel in low water. At least a metre of tide would appear a prudent minimum. At least one tug would be necessary to make the swing off the South Esent dredged basin. Wow. Once swung and secured into berth, the ramp was lowered to the wharf pad. To our consternation, the old Lysolite link span was jutting out of the seaside of our ramp. We never broke moorings and the stern swung outward. This obstruction had a potential to damage the ramp hinges. Surely the link span should go. Westernport wharfies were still new to our cranes and straddles were somewhat larger than the equipment to which they had accustomed. Discharge proceeded at a modest pace. The stevedores, Jerry Elsenberg and Alan Buck, there was huge, they broke the unions. They basically smashed unions and destroyed all the trade. I remember there was 1990s, they smashed the unions and broke all that up. Okay. Stevedores Jerry and Alan Buckthroat, though, through familiar with our railroad twins, gave us every assistance and so relayed information from Port Kembla stevedores as to how many slabs would be loading the next voyage. This was a transition period with a few of the 12-metre slabs being produced, but still many smaller slabs. Some voyages were loaded with 1,000 slabs. Obviously, when we got down to 460 of the giant slabs, operations would speed up. With less crane and straddle movements, this would also ease the wear and tear on the equipment. Eventually, the vehicle deck was needed renewal over top engine rooms due to heavy traffic causing metal structure failure. My godfather. You know what I really think? They should just roll the slab out into a barge and just carry the barges. But you've got a rolling, heavy rolling. A few voyages later, in March 87, southbound off Gubba Island, about 2 a.m, the second mate phoned the master to advise the magnetic compass. Oh, this is, again, Barnacle. This is the same information. Been wrenched free of the holding bolts, later found partly corroded, and was rolling over the upper bridge deck. Can only imagine the ferocity of our rolling to exert such forces. On return to Port Kembla, relieved at the end of the first swing, Master went to Newcastle with a copy of our computer program showing the metacentric height with all hold storage was much less than the GM if we could bring 50% of the cargo up to the vehicle deck. Management agreed to address the problem. About midway through the year, we received the Department of Transport permission to land all our hatch pontoons and trade with open holds, providing no persons were allowed inside the safety rails around each hatchway. One instance that year was the tragic capsize of the passenger Herald of Free Enterprise of Zeebrugge, where that is harbour, for the loss of 180 lives. This was caused by a failure to secure the bow doors before departing berth. In consequence, the railroad vessels all came in for a safety audit. The UK introduced requirements for the stern door indicators. The Australian Department of Transport, I remember that going down. I don't know where it went down. I remember this is the stern doors. The Australian Department of Transport were way ahead in regard and required us to have the door status indicators on the bridge ever since 1973 commissioning. Our standard orders and procedures were clearly scrutinised and generally accepted to be adequate. It was requested that we log our check procedures on each departure. Special low loader trucks that could be steered from both ends were used to land all the pontoons. The vessels traded for a few months while Port Kembla contractor was welding cargo restraint rails on the pontoons. We specified sufficient height to load the slabs four tiers high in the vehicle deck. In November 87, the vehicle returned to Port Kembla to find the platoons were ready to be returned aboard. The accomplishment with the same low loaders was previous. The following day, the vessel loaded with half the cargo on the vehicle deck. One immediate effect was a shorter loading period, was the crane lowering distance was much reduced to 50% of the slab load. The crane purchase wires can only travel around the restrictions of the sheave so many times. Wire ropes manufacturers had given the ship a formula based on the assumption that the magnet to lower the beam right to the bottom of the hole. The mates set up a computer program, and after so many slabs had been handled, it was time to renew the purchase of the wire and the crane, approximately every 5 months. This period now exceeded considerable with reduced hoist distances. To our great joy, the vessel's roll period was now a comfortable 12 seconds and the GM was now within range of our stability tanks. We could, when free aboard permitted, load 350 tonnes of water in the tank and practically eliminate rolling of significance. The distance between supports was 4.7 metres, with slabs hanging in within 6.5 to 1.8 metres. It was virtually impossible to find any number of slabs that would equal the exact 4.7 metres. There was always gaps in the stow, and this was not generally acceptable seamanship. We asked for timber guts and wedges to chock off. It was refused on grounds of industrial problems. Oh dear, question mark. The company engaged a team of computer programmers with the aim of setting up a Fortran train that would neatly assemble the slabs into groups which required the widths. But the slabs just don't come in those sizes. Back to square one. It was also evident we traded for some voyages in good conditions with no signs of any cargo movement at all, until voyage 273, when the cargo shifted in heavy trees. Jeff Hilbert was the master at the time. On the 1988, the vessel was loaded with 708 slabs weighing 12,804 tons, with the vehicle deck share being 730 slabs and weighing 5,469 tons, loaded to the course of bricks method. During the loading period, heavy rain caused problems loading the straddle trucks, where slipping on the deck studded area and water had leaked into the main switchboard. The departure GM was 1.7, with the stability tank filled to 120 tonnes of water. The vessel departed Port Kembla in 23:16 and set course to Point Perpendicular, which is, I know that's in down the course, that's Jervis Bay. Vehicle was rolling, however, controlled by the stabilising tank. The vehicle deck inspection revealed large amounts of water near the cargo. Okay, we'll finish this. It's page 93. We're going to pick this up a bit later. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.